Hi, I'm Rose Metro. This is the course, Wise My Teacher Told Me, Top 5 Myths About Burma's History. Welcome to Episode 1, History Curriculum as a Political Tool. Many people say that history is a record of what happened in the past. It is both less than that and more than that. It is less than that because all the things that happened in the past can never be included in any history. The historian must select what goes into the history book and what is left out. Their own biases inevitably influence what they include and what they exclude. The Haitian historian, Michel Rolfe Truol, points out that silences are a part of any historical narrative. These silences can enter history at several different times. First, silence can occur at the point of fact creation. When an original source, such as a stone inscription, newspaper article, record of taxes paid, or political speech is created, the creators may, and indeed must, leave some details out. Second, silence can occur at the point of assembly, when these source documents are collected and archived. Finally, silence can occur when those archives or sources are used to create historical narratives in the form of books, museum exhibits, films, or national monuments. So history is less than a record of what happened in the past, but it is also more than a record of what happened in the past. It can be a form of propaganda that governments use to legitimize their rule. It can be a weapon used to exclude some people from the rights of citizenship. It can be a prison for people's minds that prevents them from feeling empathy for others. History can start wars. The Burmese saying, pick up a weapon when you talk about history, "Dotan bi yasawingu piome," captures this point. In other words, history is a political tool. To put these two points together, always incomplete histories are used to justify all kinds of political projects. What I will discuss today is how history curricula, in particular, have been used for political purposes, both in Burma and in my own country, the United States. It is important to acknowledge that this happens all over the world, but that it happens in specific ways depending on the context. U.S. educational theorist Michael Apple pointed out that all curriculum is ideological. No school book, even math or science, contains just the facts. French educational theorists Pierre Bourdieu and Jean-Claude Passeron explained that groups with power in any society use schools as a way to ensure their continued dominance. Mostly, schools try to shape children who will not question the way things are. So we have two forces, education and history, that are closely connected to power. When they intersect in the form of the history curriculum, we can expect that there will be important consequences for society. As French philosopher Michel Foucault pointed out, knowledge and power cannot be separated. What is considered true in any society depends on who is in power. This doesn't mean that there is no historical truth. It just means that it is very hard to pin down. we have to question what we are taught about the history of our country, our region, or our ethnic group. We have to examine our own biases, and we have to listen to those who have experiences different from our own. I will give an example from my own country. I was taught in school that the US was founded on the principles of liberty and justice for all. Yet, when the US was founded, white people were enslaving Black people and committing genocide against Native Americans. Poor people were exploited. Women could not vote. My teachers would acknowledge these points, but would imply that they did not matter much because the US had made so much progress in granting rights to a widening circle of people. First, landless white men, then Black people, then women, now LGBTQ people. This is the myth of American progress. I call it a myth because it is incomplete. It creates silences. It can be called a master narrative. Any evidence that does not fit into this story is ignored or pushed to the side in schools. This happens in subtle as well as obvious ways. It is obvious that some things are left out of the school curriculum. For instance, as a child, I never learned about the Tulsa Race Massacre. In 1921, a mob of white people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, burned to the ground what was, at the time, the wealthiest Black neighborhood in the country, killing over 800 people. It may be the single worst incident of racial violence in US history, yet it does not appear in any textbook I have seen. Well, my teachers might say, that was a long time ago. We, be careful of that word we. It never includes everyone. We have made so much progress since then. But racist violence against Black people continues. Many people are now familiar with the murder of George Floyd by a police officer. This crime could easily have been a silence in the historical record if it had not been for a young woman with a cell phone camera. The video of Floyd's murder exposed how the state had prevented evidence about police brutality from being included in the historical record. There are also more subtle ways that this myth is perpetuated. For instance, one recently published US history textbook referred to, quote, millions of workers on plantations in the South in the 19th century. By choosing the word worker instead of enslaved person, this textbook silenced the brutal history of slavery because it glossed over the terrible conditions that those people endured. So history textbooks do not need to contain outright lies in order to misrepresent the past. Historians can maintain myths through the words they choose. True facts can still be used to cover up reality. For instance, it is true that slavery is now illegal in the US, but that does not mean racism or forced labor has stopped. But as historian Michelle Alexander has pointed out, white people have used the criminal justice system and mass incarceration to maintain control over Black people's lives and force them to work as prisoners for little or no pay. These master narratives can also influence us in subtle ways. Even people who know intellectually that racism still exists in the US may have found themselves assuming, when they saw the video that showed George Floyd's murder, that he had done something to deserve the treatment he got. The idea of a police officer murdering an innocent Black man in broad daylight conflicts with the myth of American progress. Instead of questioning the myth, people may try to make the facts conform to it. This is why it is so important to examine the master narratives that we have been taught. With every myth, we can ask ourselves how it came about, how it is maintained, and who benefits from it. In this case, the myth of American progress benefits people who already have most power in US society, wealthy white men. If history books convince those at the bottom of the social hierarchy that there is already liberty and justice for all, they may think that their own struggles are due to bad luck or personal failings rather than due to a system that is rigged against them, and they are less likely to demand reparations for past and ongoing discrimination. When I was in high school, I was exposed to a book that changed the course of my life. It was called Lies My Teacher Told Me: Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. In it, James Loewen deconstructed the myths that I was being fed in school, showing how master narratives about the US had silenced historical facts that did not fit into those simple stories. I was inspired to become a history teacher myself. Today, I train teachers and I also write textbooks that I hope help to fill in some of the silences that have been passed down to us. Just as there are silences in US history, there are also silences in Myanmar's history. Successive regimes have used history to pursue their own political goals. I would like to illustrate this by using the example of King Chansitha and how he has been presented in histories from the 12th century until the present. When Chansitha was king, he ordered what are now known as the Myagan inscriptions to be carved in stone. The inscriptions described the irrigation canals he had built. Here's what one inscription said: "The king of the law, who was foretold by the Lord Buddha, who is great in love and compassion toward all beings, to the end that all beings may obtain happiness, bliss, and plenty, and be free of famine from tillage, in every place that lacks water, lacks arable land, lacks strenuous cultivation, our Lord, the King of the Law, dams the water, digs a tank, and thus creates arable land and strenuous cultivation." Chansitha doesn't mention all the people his soldiers must have killed while expanding his empire. He makes himself look good. He writes down only what he wants people to remember. This is an example of silence entering the historical record at the point of fact creation, as Toole would say. In 1829, rulers of the Gombaun dynasty had the Glass Palace Chronicle composed. They emphasized the size of Chansitha's realm, also to make themselves look good. UK-based historian Michael Charney described how these Gombaun kings composed the chronicle partly to show the British that they had a large, strong, and long-lasting empire that should not be colonized. So in addition to mentioning the irrigation canals from the Myagan inscriptions, they carefully noted the size of Chansitha's empire. The British also used King Chansitha to make themselves look good. G.E. Harvey's Outline of the History of Burma, which was published in 1926 and used as a textbook in colonial schools, claimed that Chansitha had started a war between the Burman and the Mon people, which was still going on and which only the British could pacify. He wrote, "The news that King Chansitha was present in person spread dismay among the Mons marching eastward to bar his road. Chansitha's men burned to avenge a previous battle and free their homes." It is not clear how Harvey knew what soldiers 500 years ago were thinking and feeling. Yet Harvey draws the conclusion, based on his conjectures, that the people of Burma are better off under British rule. He writes, "The British Empire came to give Burma that unity which Burman kings could not provide, and the reform scheme to give her the power to make it a true unity welling up from within, not an artificial unity imposed from without." The reinterpretation of Chansitha continues in the independence era. Bul Bashin's 1948 Myanmar history, which was also used as a school textbook, claimed that Chansitha had unified the ethnic groups, not started a war. He finds one detail in the Glass Palace Chronicle, that Chansitha married his daughter to a Mon prince, and he uses this to claim Chansitha wanted to promote friendship with the Mon. In this way, Bul Bashin emphasizes the image of unified and peaceful ethnic groups. Amidst the beginning of a civil war, it is easy to see why Burmese nationalists would prefer this version of Chansitha to the one Harvey had created. When the BSPP came to power, Chansitha became a kind of socialist. Their textbooks noted that he expanded the means of production, including farmland, irrigation canals, wells, and reservoirs. Whereas in the SPDC's textbooks, all the powerful Burman kings, including Chansitha, do three things: build unity among ethnic groups, promote economic prosperity, and propagate Buddhism. It is not a coincidence that state newspapers showed the SPDC doing those same exact three things day after day. We see how, in each era, historians' political goals influence how they describe King Chansitha. Chansitha does not change, but historians emphasize different aspects about his life and silence others, depending on what they want students to think about contemporary society. Historians also attempt to fill silences with new ideas, depending on the current context. Bourdieu and Passeron's ideas may make more sense now. People in power often use the curriculum, and in particular, the history curriculum, to shore up their dominance. This is true in Myanmar, it is true in the US, and it is true almost everywhere in the world. We can question the lies our teachers told us. We don't have to be angry with them. They were also misled. But by looking at multiple sources and listening to different perspectives, we can build a more complete version of history. All history contains ideology. So why not seek out histories that are compatible with a democratic society and a federal union? Histories that include the voices of all people in Myanmar. That is what we will be doing in this course.